So I just wanted to start with this image because Ella was talking earlier about furries on public transportation, and I just want you to know that it's possible. He doesn't have a tail, but he certainly gets around, and you see him on the L train all the time. He offers free bouncy rides, so. No. No, you should have wrote it. Anyway. My talk is off-centered. That's probably all right. It's automobile, casino, public square, the problems of virtual space. On the website, I think it's listed a little bit differently, but I changed it at the last minute. I'm going to be talking kind of about the internet as a physical space. So a little bit different, but in our attempts to understand and explain the internet, we turn immediately to metaphors of physical spaces. The interactive nature of the internet lends itself to a feeling that we're navigating a space. As I sit in my room surfing, I don't think of myself as being in my room, but as being someplace else, connected through a set of applications to the rest of the world. Instead of separated from it by a set of walls. But the set of metaphors we tend to use only take us so far, and perhaps they function as unnecessary constraints on our understanding of the internet and what it does to our minds. The systems we encounter online are only vaguely analogous to what we encounter in physical space, and we need a different set of tools for navigating these systems. Every planned physical space, cities, transportation networks, buildings, vehicles, has its own rules for how we interact with each other in those spaces. Its own accepted communication methods for carrying out the messy business of getting around other human beings. This talk is an exploration of a few of the metaphors that help us understand how the internet operates, but only to a certain extent. In considering these metaphors, we should also consider how and why they collapse, and what we can learn about the internet as we watch familiar restrictions disintegrate. The absence of any one accepted understanding of what the internet is for and how we should behave online allows virtual space to become, at times, an anarchic landscape that must be read on its own terms alone. In 1991, at the dawn of the World Wide Web, Frederick Jameson wrote, "This latest mutation in postmodern hyperspace has finally succeeded in transcending the capacities of the individual human body to locate itself, to map its position in a mappable external world. It may now be suggested that this alarming disjunction point between the body and its built environment, which is to the initial bewilderment of the older modernism as the velocities of spacecraft to those of the automobile, can itself stand as the symbol and analogon of that even sharper dilemma, which is the incapacity of our minds, at least at present, to map the great global multinational and decentered communicational network in which we find ourselves caught as individual subjects." Here, Jameson hints at an anxiety over the changing status of the body in subjectivity. Almost 20 years later, we have still not developed a solid methodology for mapping the internet, let alone understanding our places in it. But how important is it for us to complete such a map of a system whose dynamism is one of its most essential characteristics? What would be the purpose of such a map, and whom would it serve? I'm inclined to agree with Keller Easterling. The information highway is a blunt and inaccurate term to describe the net's efflorescence and immateriality. If anything, the idea that our new networks might resemble the generic landscape of the highway is less a promise than a threat for those who stand to gain from the imposition of a standardized template rather than a variable network that achieves flexibility and intelligence through differentiation. By this light, we should begin in earnest with the promise discussion. Developing and interrogating metaphors for the internet may not be sufficient to fully comprehend what the internet is, and we may do ourselves a disservice if we claim that they are sufficient, but through these interrogations, we may acquire some methodology for reading the internet. The internet as a space is one that we move through, and we may never feel truly stationary in an environment where all the images change and move around us. It is a development in speed, in technology that removes time and distance as separating factors. In Negative Horizon, Paul Virilio outlines the history of civilization by examining vehicles and human acceleration, ultimately concluding that disappearance is the goal of the war machine, and that this disappearance finds its way into our everyday lives through the proliferation of faster and faster vehicles. Virilio writes, as if the materialist West, with the revolution of transports, installed its metempsychosis in the present movement of bodies without awaiting the transmigrations of birth or death, the industry of movement accelerates, transfers from here to there, from one to the other, we cast off, enclosed in the differential of speeds, walled in by the energy of the traveling, we are less human than we are station. If this is true of the automobile, what does it say about our spatial and social relationship to the internet? If the progress of technology and thus society and history can be measured against the development of faster vehicles as Virilio imagines, then the internet is an almost perfect vehicle. Bound only by the speed of electronic transfer, with physical distance as a negligible factor, we spend almost no time traveling from one point to the next. I think the internet is a vehicle as much as it is also a route and a destination. This is a tough trinity to comprehend, but I believe we are capable of understanding a space we inhabit, where we spend more and more of our lives. The car in America is already a space of personal reflection, of intimacy with the self and the mind, of mental transportation and emotional transmigration. We may approach the multiple nature of the internet by applying Virilio's ideas about vehicles and acceleration to our first point of contact, our computers. A theory of the internet as automobile acknowledges that you're residing alone in front of a screen, a windshield between you and everyone else. The psychological experience is similar to what you get when navigating around other drivers. Like the automobile, the internet symbolizes separation from others as well as a broader range of travel, dependence on the means of transit as well as increased production, isolation as well as freedom. We make our cars look like computers and vice versa. And the boys' clubs dedicated to building and modifying these vehicles bear striking resemblances to one another. The male agency that hinges on power over the vehicle motivates production and development, to the point where most mass-produced cars and computers have an aura of exclusionary masculinity. Our cars move us geographically from point A to point B. We get time and distance for separation, but we still associate the same physical space with going to work and going home. Computers connect us to work and home simultaneously, and time online isn't distinctly allocated. We need only to consider how much of the population now telecommutes. Why spend the extra money to transport a worker physically when her productive output is the same if she stays home? The need for office space dissolves, and workers are responsible for translating the discipline of the cubicle into their own living rooms. So maybe we'll all just start shooting our families again. So the new vehicles further the mission of the old vehicles. They guarantee that we're never too far from our work, that we do not forget about it, that work is woven tightly into the fabric of our lives. Virilio argues later in Negative Horizon that driving automobiles is a form of cinema because the scenery, the road, the other drivers are distorted due to speed. If the windshield is a type of screen and vice versa, then we're spending our lives before these projections, watching the world warp around us. But does the distortion of space and reality necessarily result in isolation and alienation? When the screen separates us from physical realities and alters our perceptions, does this always mean we are relocated in a new psychological space where we are always alone, closed off from our world? Virilio writes, it is meanwhile revealing to consider the historical evolution of the various driving seats. If yesterday we still flew in the open air in contact with the atmosphere, hearing the sound of the motor and the wind, and sensing the vibration of the machine, we also note that the excess of speed has contributed to a progressive enclosing of the driver, first behind the screen of a simple glass windscreen, then the full windshield and enclosed cabin. The physical and environmental constraints of speed have required us to seal ourselves in more and more thoroughly as we accelerate. Certain speeds, after all, are unamenable to our bodies, but we have not been especially bothered by limitations of the human body in the past century. The internet reverses this tradition. I can navigate at the speed of my network with a piece of glass the size of my hand as a screen. Telecommunication has displaced the need for travel for almost a century, and the internet provides limitless potential for communication over vast differences. The location of our bodies is still important in some, but not all, cases. But consider the range of options we have now and the range of meanings we're able to transmit via our online channels. Somehow, though, we know that we're enclosed in something when we travel in virtual space. We have a hard time defining it and describing this enclosure because it is not of the vehicle. In Society of the Spectacle, Guy Debord writes, while eliminating geographical distance, the society produces new internal distance in the form of spectacular separation. I think the implication is that the internal distance is somehow greater, more insurmountable, more insidious than geographical distance. I'm not convinced this is the case, but we should not mistake the irrelevance of geography for artificial proximity. That is to say, we are still distant, but modern spectacle replaces physical distance from some things with psychological distance from everything. At the heart of the new spectacle and its new distance are our computers. Our computers present a complex object relationship, the likes of which we have never seen, but we should avoid saying that the computer is to the internet what the car is to the road or to the destination. I want to divert the discussion here for a moment to talk about more about our computers and our relationship to them. Computers are literally built into our lives. Billboards, projection screens, walls that come alive with the activity of circuits, transistors and light-emitting diodes, gadgets as fashion, robotic voices that echo through our constructed environments. Not since the Industrial Revolution has the progress of technology shaped our everyday experiences so much, altered the convolutions of our synapses, captured our entire manifold attention. The objects at the source of this new world, our computers, remain mystified and obscure to the multitudes who live with them. The apparatuses of networks are often literally invisible. We do not see the buried cables, much less the wavelengths moving bits through the air around us. We press on our keys and mice and touch screens, and the electronic removal from input to output is almost incomprehensible. It doesn't take much technical knowledge to understand the mechanical transfer of energy between my foot and the gas pedal and the movement of a car. The only science you need to understand it is experiential. Every process is translatable into something familiar to even pre-industrial people. If you can understand cooking and walking, you can understand auto mechanics. But computers are different, especially now. As our technology grows more complex and sophisticated, we actually need less of an understanding of what's really going on at every level of a process in order to interact with the machine. Personal electronics have few, if any, moving parts, so everything we know about mechanics is irrelevant. Instead of a visible, comprehensible system of combustion and motion, our computers operate on micro-scale electronic transfers that most people will never directly observe. The history of software development is a narrative in which interfaces are made more user-friendly as the structures behind them become more powerful. Better hardware means more room between the circuits and you, in which the bits can gestate, the information translate into something more familiar, and maybe more human. Personal electronics are some of the stranger bedfellows of capital. As we get better at making them, we get farther from an understanding of how they actually work. The Western workforce is amazingly well-versed in a pidgin language of computing. We memorize a set of procedures and hope that no variables arise to keep us from our work. With the introduction of sophisticated home computers and personal devices, we've extended our strange relationship to the computer into our private lives. The line between work and private life gets even blurrier online. Those of us who have traditionally demarcated workplaces stay connected to our office networks at home, and we log into our personal email and social networking accounts at work. The jury is still out on what exactly this does to our overall productivity, although we've heard a little bit about that already. There are compelling arguments on both sides. Spending hours on the clock browsing the internet is deemed theft of company time by many employers, but we may also investigate the benefits of downtime and a sense of freedom in the workplace. I think we should also consider that there may be a panopticon effect operating here, in that employers reserve the right to monitor any activity on internal networks. Workers are aware of constant surveillance, but it backfires on employers when the policy isn't enforced, or when no one is watching. How a worker feels about her online freedom in the workplace is an interesting discussion to have. I guess we already had it. But I'm somewhat more interested in what happens when the worker goes home. Are we better workers because we bring our private lives to the office, or are we losing the sanctity of our private lives because we take them to work? What then do we do inside of these spaces, our cars, our online realities, that isn't work? How do we repurpose them, make them our own again, resist appropriation by our employers and exploiters of these fetish objects that are supposed to be our own personal property? We use them for sex. Car sex implies a taboo act, the need for a getaway vehicle, a desire we can't fulfill inside our homes. We know from experience, whether we're aware of it or not, that cars are among the most private spaces we have at our disposal. So we bring a partner into the automobile's isolating atmosphere. We transform it, heavy with a painful self-intimacy, into one of urgent sexuality where both parties understand mutually where they are situated, even if they understand nothing else. The internet sharpens other properties of the automobile, enhances and adjusts its capacity for speed and cinematic distortion of reality. It follows that the isolation we feel while gesturing silently to other transients on the road is heightened proportionally online, and there's no one in the passenger seat. There are other people, millions of them, all around us, but none with a perfectly shared experience. It makes sense, then, that sex online is often a one-way transaction in which there is an individual and there is porn. But sex online doesn't just mean that pornography is readily available, because billions of humans exchanging bits of information is inevitably going to result in a staggering amount of desire. My talk on gender identity and social networking 2 years ago, I discussed the irrelevance of bodies in online interactions and argued that social networking permits the expression of identities that are incompatible with our biology. I think this is a powerful thing, because it gives people the freedom to engage in sexualities that don't match the bodies available to us. I'm talking about the same idea here, plus Internet Rule 34, which states that for any imaginable scenario, my personal favorites are dragons fucking cars and David Duchovny and Saran Wrap. It's real. There's a group of people discussing it online and getting off on it together. It's hard to see this as anything but positive. We know what it feels like to find another person with whom you have something in common long after you've dismissed the possibility. It feels great, it's an affirmation of humanity and a validation of self, and it makes us feel less alone. The question then, if we're still talking about spaces, is where does this leave us? Are we forced back into a space of isolation and alienation by the virtue of the screen, or are we brought into the light of a crowd so large that we inevitably bump into ourselves? And if the internet is the only space where we can find fulfilling companionship, can we tolerate this condition? It would be an understatement to say that popular culture balks at people who would rather build online relationships than interact with those in close physical proximity. We fear and resist a way of life where the screen takes over completely, and we eagerly dismiss online relationships as not real. The easy explanation for our resistance hinges on our bodies. Our bodies represent every definition of humanity that we know. They grow and change and expire and define our lives. We're stuck with them, after all, and somebody's got to touch them or we go crazy. Therefore, in the only logic we know, any individual who is fulfilled by virtual contact alone is either crazy or lying. A predilection for sex online gets read as a weird fetish, a sexually dysfunctional desire that is incompatible with the mechanics of sex as we understand it. We've already established that existing online requires a different mode of thinking and a different logical methodology to read the internet and a different approach to social, political, and economic transactions. So why not a different understanding of sexuality? It's ironic that a culture so obsessed with repressing its biological needs and sexual desires would decide that a physical act, one that we won't even talk about, is so important that people who don't need it or want it are insane. Before I move on, I'll return to Valerio and his automobiles. Finally, whether we consider the acceleration of the telematic transmission of data, millisecond, bit second, or the supersonic transport of people, kilometers per hour or Mach, matters little since, as we have seen earlier, speed is the message, the last message of movement. It makes sense to analyze the cinematic nature of the transmitted information, and this no matter what sort of vehicular performance, subsonic or supersonic, of machines or instruments of transmission, audio, visual, or automobile, may be involved. Five, six. I forgot to type up the second half of the quote. It goes like this. Even if the most spectacular effects of the wheel are now reserved for sophisticated instruments, it continues to be the case nonetheless that each vehicle possesses the vectorial property to transmit through its speed the objective reality of the course as much as the informational content, even the meaning of discourse. That was sort of the area. What we have so far is a picture of the internet as a closed system, one that we inhabit as solitary beings, moving along its conduits and occasionally stopping for a meaningful interaction with other travelers. But we know also that spending time online doesn't always feel like driving, and we spend as much time parked as we do moving. Our experience of the internet and its role in our lives doesn't stop when we step away from our computers, in part because we stay connected on our mobile devices, and we live in a culture where the internet is everywhere, even if it isn't in our pockets. We're constantly aware that it drives commerce and art, and we are at once comforted and disconcerted to realize that it keeps moving without us. With over 500 million active users, Facebook is the single most popular destination on the internet. Those of us who aren't perpetually connected to it return often to see what has happened since our last visit, to keep our networks updated with news from our own lives. Facebook intersects with our outside lives more and more, but there's something about the closed space of Facebook that reminds us of its virtual surreality, its circumstantial removal from more familiar contexts. That's not right. I think there are elements of the hotel slash casino in today's Facebook. Casinos are designed to keep your attention on the action, away from the ceilings and floors, and anything else that resembles any other kind of structure. A casino has no windows facing out, no visual cues to remind you of your position in relation to anything else except the casino. Consider that while Facebook offers an easy way to post outgoing links to other sites, those sites open in a new browser tab or window, and on mobile devices, they open in Facebook's own proprietary browser. According to Facebook's statistic page, there are more than 150 million active users currently accessing Facebook through their mobile devices. People that use Facebook on their mobile devices are twice as active on Facebook than non-mobile users. Okay. So even if your outgoing activity is under the umbrella of Facebook's interface, and since the introduction of public pages, corporations and other public entities have used the closed world of Facebook to accomplish what their own websites cannot. Constant presence and hegemony in the increasingly frequent and pervasive online activity of customers and potential customers alike. Once outside of Facebook's domain, we can still see into the network. There are like buttons everywhere, invitations to become a fan, counters displaying how many of your friends have already joined up. Here's where the analogy breaks down. The casino doesn't follow you home. Someplace above the marketing, we retire back to our private suites to carry on our interpersonal business. What happens on Facebook gets imbued with a unique set of meanings. Exchanges between people have a third audience of thousands. Different social circles have different developed responses to breaches of protocol. Love is won and lost in detail on stage to the background noise of marketing games and data mining. In the casino, sex functions as a commodity, as a signifier that inhabits the structure of institutionalized gambling along with pawn shops, slot machines, and free cocktails. Casino gambling holds a pervasive air of Western capitalist machismo and provides a theater in which the money, sex, associations, and exchanges that exist in the outside world drop their veils and twirl their tassels. I think this happens for two reasons. The capitalist tendency towards financial risk-taking acquires a totally transparent and blatant form in casino gambling, and casinos provide the physical separation from the outside world necessary for these relations to be made visible. I'm hesitant to say this is a phenomenon because all we're really getting is a louder, more visible version of the commodified sexuality with which late capitalism is saturated. Sexual Puritanism and capitalism grew up together. The economic priorities are intertwined tightly with the cultural need to impose heteronormative structures. The proliferation of patriarchal authority depends upon careful control over sexuality. And under late capitalism, authority also depends upon its own opacity. Revealing the mechanics of control would undermine the subversive efforts to keep us in line. That is to say, the operative relations between sexuality and capital are obscured or distorted by normative culture, and this distortion holds people back from a real understanding of biopower. Casinos exist as unique spaces where the distortion is at a minimum, and otherwise repressed sexualities and desires express themselves in a contained environment. The same thing happens online, specifically on social networks like Facebook. Instead of betting chips for money, we bet friendships and reputations for attention. Everybody starts on an equal playing field with the same set of tools, and from there we create images and representations of ourselves in an attempt to acquire and hold the attention of others. This is a broad description. I'm talking at once about posting lurid accounts of your personal life at the risk of offending your family, and about exaggerating your professional qualifications at the risk of being assigned a task that's beyond your means to perform. The stakes are what you make them. Thanks to the value of images and the meanings we've imposed on visual signifiers online, the social network profile is inherently sexual. The internet's history is written in pornography and sexual acting out, and there are never more than a few digital degrees of separation between one seemingly non-sexual image and a rush of bits to the erotic nodes. In other words, what we have is a virtual space in which the exchange of media is as much a sex act as the exchange of bodily fluids. We have an extensive continuum of how public we want these acts to be, depending upon the level of attention we're after. This is the wager. But this is the structure we asked for. Escapism is a powerful drug, so is gambling. And the glittering opulent safety of a world where what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas is temptation enough to draw in the multitudes. The casino contains its own rules of capitalism. The illusion of easy money and perpetual wealth provide a welcome reprieve from the harder fought battles outside. Outside the casino, on the ground, capitalism is a complicated machine that requires a specific and rare set of circumstances in order for an individual to suddenly become wealthy. The new rules level the playing field, if only temporarily. Social networking provides a similar equalizing mechanism. Just throw out the right random thought in the right form for instant popularity. In both cases, what's won is short-lived and shallow. In both cases, we profess to hate the end product of the environments we've asked for. That our recreation and social life have been appropriated for corporate profit is something we're smugly aware of, and it's cool not to care. But to what extent is our lack of concern or action a part of the trap? I think the most insidious part of the casino Facebook metaphor is this. Both institutions only profit for as long as we inhabit their spaces, and that habitation transforms into varying levels of addiction. Our defense is to claim that we're having fun and we can stop whenever we like. But what does it take to walk away from the casino when you're $1,000 or so in the hole? And what does it take to walk away from Facebook when it's your primary way of connecting with the people in your life? Participation in Facebook is a cycle of increasing dependence, and we're becoming increasingly rooted in a space where we are increasingly uncomfortable. If we accept that the house always wins, how long do we stay at the farm bill table, tossing around private data in exchange for a few hours of synchronized clicking with our most distant friends? The data we lay out has little or no value to us, but it's immensely valuable for the dealer, and this is a tough thing to conceptualize. There's a separate discussion to be had about how vigilant we can or should be about privacy, but the house always wins against the most careful player. I'm going to drink these chemicals. They're really good. Going back to postmodernism, Frederick Jameson spends several pages considering the Westin Bonaventura Hotel in Los Angeles as an example of a postmodern space that produces disorientation as a way of imposing itself and its logic. Reading his ideas now, it seems he could just as easily have been talking about the internet in present time. What happens when you get there is something else, which can only be characterized as known confusion, something like the vengeance this space takes on those who still seek to walk through it. The internet as public square requires that we look beyond its role in individual lives and consider its effects on the masses. The internet doesn't exist without its billions of inhabitants, the corporate interests that use it for profit, the public institutions that have moved their offices and libraries into view online. We simultaneously step into the marketplace and town hall, the theater and public park. I think this metaphor holds so much weight because public squares as they existed in earlier periods of human history have almost disappeared. No other city architecture provides a space for so many forms of public life at once, perhaps because automobiles removed the need for centralization as they handed us our postmodern condition. It is interesting, then, to consider that the internet has brought us back together again in a single space where everybody does everything. If we return for a moment to the casino metaphor, we remember that networking creates a hegemonic force that hyperlinks all these aspects of our lives back together. The last metaphor is the simplest on its face. I don't need to spell out that shopping online or looking at art online is a lot like shopping or looking at art in physical space. It gets complicated when we consider the differences in how the internet is constructed versus how strip malls and public gathering spaces are designed and built. The internet is all image. The goods for sale, the people you meet, everything. When Du Bois wrote Society of the Spectacle in 2000, he was reflecting on the past century of modern and postmodern development of images as reality replacements. I think the internet for Du Bois 10 years ago was probably one more invention in the same vein as television, and he thought it projected the same images we were already seeing and just reproduced more of them. Even if he doesn't specifically discuss the unique properties of the internet as a communication tool, his more general observations are still useful. The second item in his list, and if you haven't read Society of the Spectacle, it's just a good list, is this definition. The spectacle is not a collection of images. It is a social relation between people that is mediated by images. We can't parse the meaning of anything we see without first acknowledging that its significance is based on our social relations. That is to say, images mean what we have agreed they mean. There is a grammar involved, a system of signification that becomes its own language when we have the internet's weight in images to consider. Architecture of our physical environments is bound by material science, topography, weather, and gravity. So architects are not permitted to design spaces that come purely from our culture and social conditions. Web design is more or less restricted by the available rates of data transfer and processing power. You can't build an inhabitable multimedia experience when neither you nor your user can access very many images at once. Arguably, we're still at that point. What would the internet look like if everyone in the world had gigabits per second data connections, terabytes of graphics memory, processors that made PS3 clusters look like Ataris, and power sources that didn't rely on expensive chemical fuels? We'd have pretty impressive holograms of cats falling into boxes. The point isn't to lust after the future, at least not yet. That we know development and augmentation of images into forms we can scarcely imagine will continue should not keep us from considering the current state of the internet as a space governed by images to an unprecedented extent. Du Bois offers us another definition of spectacle shortly thereafter. The spectacle is capital accumulated to the point that it becomes images. Online, everything becomes images. I interpret Du Bois here as suggesting that spectacle is what happens when there is a surplus productive energy, capital that has exhausted its material possibilities and so spills into the immateriality of images. Of course, this is not the end of capital. It is an evolution into a new form that is not bound by limited physical resources, and it still carries on the capitalist mission of reproducing the means of production. The internet and our computers are their own factories. Instead of one factory that produces machinery for a new machine-producing factory, the internet exists in a constant productive state of its own production. Images exist to give rise to more images, and nowhere is this more apparent than the internet, where design encourages and facilitates more design. Public spaces have always contained images, and public spaces of the last century have always contained spectacle. We have become increasingly literate in the visual vocabulary of advertisements, the visual grammar of electoral politics, the visual structures of bureaucracy. But we're also used to seeing these images in context of a physical space, billboards on the roadside, posters on the bus stops, signifying facades on buildings. The screen transformed this experience of spectacle with television before computers, as cinematic technology delivered images against the backdrop of our own homes. The internet becomes a public space in a way television as technology never could for the reasons I've already discussed. It is public and not merely common. Because we interact with it, we navigate it as if it were a physical environment rather than observing it passively. What does this mean for our public lives online? What about our social relations change when images exist only on their own terms in the context of more and more images? We no longer have to traverse a physical distance between the grocery store and the voting booth, but have they actually gotten closer together? Certainly the new dynamics of internet spectacle have transformed our minds and the way we approach the world, but how? I don't think we can necessarily answer these questions yet, and any attempt to do so will need to take into account the accelerated change online, the violently shifting sands of the virtual. Our best resource in creating a sketch of our place online may be theories of the multitude, in which we explore relations and conditions of populations under capitalism and post-Fordist culture. In his introduction to A Grammar of the Multitude, Paolo Reno writes, the contemporary multitude is composed neither of citizens nor of producers. It occupies a middle region between the individual and collective. For the multitude, then, the distinction between public and private is in no way validated. And it is precisely because of the dissolution of the coupling of these terms, for so long held to be obvious, that one can no longer speak of a people converging into the unity of the state. But here's the point. This unity is no longer the state. Rather, it is language, intellect, the communal faculties of the human race. The one is no longer a promise, it is a premise. Unity is no longer something, the state, the sovereign, towards which things converge, as in the case of the people. Rather, it is taken for granted as a background or necessary precondition. The many must be thought of as the individuation of the universal, of the generic, of the shared experience. Thus, in a systematic manner, we must conceive of a one which, far from being something conclusive, might be thought of as the base which authorizes differentiation or which allows for the political social existence of the many being seen as many. The last of our rigid cultural borders vanishes on the free internet. We have at last a gathering place for the multitude. If post-Fordist anxiety and anguish are characterized by a feeling of being alone in a crowd, as Bruno argues, perhaps the internet can serve as an unlikely antidote. Moving through any crowd, the point is to have as little to do with everyone else as possible. There are a lot of reasons and implications for this very modern condition, and a lot of work has already been done to explain and attempt to solve the problem. It's a problem for us as individuals because it wears down our capacity for empathy. It turns us against each other, forces us to fortify our psychological barriers between our lives and the rest of the world. The nature of isolation convinces us, too, that nobody else could possibly be having the same experience. How then can we possibly work together for anything? How can we look at our fellow citizens and understand that we have a common condition, a common problem, a common enemy in the alienating mission of capital? Antonio Negri's definition of the common might be useful here. The common is an activity, not a result. It is an assemblage or an open continuity, not a densification of control. Is this actually what we get on the internet? Yes and no. As hard as the internet works against differentiation and separation of spaces, we still have marked differences between our online spaces of commerce, bureaucracy, social life, sexuality, etc. A lot of this differentiation has to do with images and with design. Images signify which aspect of digital life we're dealing with, and who is around to enforce the rules and maintain the status quo. As we've said, online communities come up with their own methods of self-control and policing, and hierarchies are definitely present even in the most anarchic online spaces. For the online initiate, these mechanics are transparent if not definable. We read websites critical enough that we can identify the structures at work without having to consider where this knowledge comes from. But I think we need to be consciously aware of how familiar hegemony translates into the virtual. The same communities are marginalized, the same forces remain the most visible, and our voices are subject to the same surveillance and censorship. In fact, surveillance and censorship are more possible and more insidious online than they have been elsewhere in our history. Because every site is open and public, because our search tools are so powerful, because even the most careful citizens leave records of their activity, we have given implicit permission for everything we do to be monitored by anyone. The cliche that there is no privacy online is true, and so far we have only seen people's lives and work marginalized when their more incriminating online activity is exposed. But I think it's possible that the sum total of an individual's online life can provide a productive kind of perspective on every part of itself. Perhaps we should not be afraid of the person who reads our resumes and academic articles, also finding our crappy poetry and drunken photographs, because the combination of these things represents us more fully, and we tell a comprehensive story of who we are. Given that the identities we construct for one audience are accessible to any other audience we may have online, we must consider the whole of our virtual presence. The internet as public square locates us as members of a vast global community, but just as urban planning dictates what is at the center and what is outside, so the forces at work in the outside world impose artificial barriers in the form of paywalls, mandatory account creation, limited access, and more. If net neutrality dies, our public spaces will be limited to those built for us by corporations and public interests. It is important that we realize then just what we have for the moment, the freedom to be ourselves, to be seen, to see any images we want, to communicate with anyone and everyone. To some extent, the internet presents a complicated dialectical tension between the public and private. That is not to say that anything is private online, because we already know that nothing is, but that our private and public lives play out alongside each other. We have seen for centuries the oppression to which we're subject in polite society, and we have seen how the imposed need for restraint isolates us from ourselves and from each other. The internet has the potential to expose everything about us at once, whether we control the images or not, and there has been a great deal of resistance and fear operating against the openness of our networks. Home entertainment has reinforced and crystallized our alienation for a century. With radio and television, it was no longer necessary to be among other people in order to be entertained. Leisure now feels better when there aren't any strangers around, when the experience feels like yours and no one else's. As you've already seen, the internet certainly promotes and amplifies this condition in a lot of very visible ways. We've all witnessed and perhaps participated in the awfully cliche contemporary tableau of people in the midst of social intercourse, eating dinner, watching a sports game, whatever, all looking at their smartphones and not talking to each other. On the surface, the tableaus of technology dependence make it look as though we've stopped talking to each other entirely. Retreated completely through our own private screens into our own realities. And we have spent the greater part of this discussion trying to understand the shape of our new isolation, but we know also that there is something else at work here. After decades of moving farther apart from each other emotionally as our population density increases, perhaps we've decided to break the silence by talking to everyone at once. I think we forgot how to talk to strangers a long time ago, and the enclaves of Western society who claim otherwise are either phonies or are managing still to exist on the farthest peripheries of the multitude. We forgot how to talk to strangers, but we didn't forget that we wanted to. So with nothing left to talk about except our private lives, since everything that was once common moved farther and farther into our individual subjectivities, got internalized and differentiated from our real conditions of life, and a new form where you could shout into the void as much as you wanted and dream that someone was listening, how could we not explode into exhibitionism? How could we not invent ways to plead for attention? The multitude is afraid of itself, meaning that every constituent is afraid of every constituent, including herself. I think it's possible to break down that fear, but only if we understand the condition first. The multitude is not an easy concept for our brains, which so far have had only to deal with the bleating infancy of civilization. In the postmodern world of the individual subject, we will need to confront the conditions of our alienation from ourselves and each other before we can become many under our own power. The internet doesn't help us if it's read as a place we go to feel complacent in isolation, or a place where everybody talks constantly and says nothing. It doesn't help us if we think of it as a simple continuation of the technology we've already seen, as a familiar and logical step on our march from loneliness to more loneliness, anguish, and despair. We need to understand its multidirectional operation, to look at every angle simultaneously, and see them as inseparable aspects of a paradoxically dense whole.
Thank you very much. Questions, remarks? Okay. Hi. I'm wondering if, because I think I walked in a minute or two late, so I'm wondering if you gave any thought to the psychological distancing that goes on when you're riding in a taxi, where you're sitting in the back and you're treating it like a TV show because there's, you know, a sheet of plexiglass that's protecting you from, you know, whatever things the driver may be doing.
That's a good one. I've been in taxi cabs where the driver was having phone sex. I've been in taxi cabs where the driver told me if he was president, he would fuck everyone in the ass. I don't know what it is. I live in New York, by the way. In case you couldn't tell. Yes, I hate them so much. They do. If you haven't been in a taxi in New York in a while, they have these little captive audience machines where you're supposed to watch ABC News and...
Yahoo! Isn't it like Yahoo?
I just turn it off as soon as I sit down, so I don't really know. And then they tell you that the credit card machine doesn't work when it fucking does. But none of that answers your question. I think the taxi thing is really interesting because you are being driven, but it's more of, it's more of like a social subservience interaction, like with somebody who cuts your hair, cleans your laundry. It's like he's in a service position, as opposed to, you know, really being part of your transport in a certain way. At least that's kind of how I've always felt about it. But the screen there is interesting too, because it's not, the divider isn't there to protect you from the environment the way a windshield is. It's to protect the cab driver from you. So that's pretty intriguing. I guess, I mean, you could do like a whole 45 minutes on like the sexual politics of like riding in a cab. like whether you're alone and puking or whatever.
I'm just fascinated by the idea that when you're
driving, I'm just fascinated by the idea that when you yourself are driving, you're constantly aware of every possible danger, and when you're the passenger, you just kind of turn that off.
Well, not in New York. But yeah, I guess ideally when you're driving, you're aware of your surroundings, but most people aren't. And ideally when you're in a taxi, you're like doing kind of your own thing and not listening to the driver have phone sex. But I really think in most cases it doesn't work out that way practically.
I loved your talk. Thank you so much for giving it. One of the things that it brought up for me is this idea of context. And I do a lot of work around sexuality advocacy and activism for a lot of different areas. One of the arguments that your talk kind of brought to mind was the pro-porn, kind of anti-porn divide among the way that the internet, among feminists and other politicians and advocacy groups, largely around the internet, largely around things like that you can't unsee something, like we heard earlier, and a lot of arguments here are, and that's such a horrible thing, from an anti-porn contingent mindset. And you're talking a lot of, I guess, empathy for why they might be afraid of that. And I think I'm trying to get to a question here. I haven't really formulated it because you have a lot to think about. But I'm wondering if you can speak to or how you put much thought around the individuation of the images themselves when put together in a context that sort of is not really intended to be taken as individuals. You know what I mean? Like it's somebody like taking a frame from a movie and then showing that as indicative of the movie when there's much more around it. So like, case in point, if I do a search result, if I do a search query for you, I might get one thing you wrote. And clearly that's not you. But when I can only see that, or when I have like this deep linkability into you, into you know what you've got, then the context that I first see you, or an image of porn, or an image that I might be uncomfortable with, changes dramatically. And I'm wondering, I guess the question, if there's anyone here, and I apologize if there's anyone here, is how do you see it as a next step, or perhaps where do you think how do you think we can start building empathy around that idea of there's more to me than what makes the eye at first? And we sort of have this in person, but online we have this incredible ability to that deep linking thing, which seems to be the thing most people are so afraid of, that lack of context.
I think that's kind of what's so exciting about it, because, you know, like online, you really don't have any control over what somebody's first impression of you is going to be. Like, you know, you might, like, for all I know, you might have seen some comment that I posted on, like, a mutual friend's Facebook page, like, a million years ago, and you've already made that association, like, with me. And, you know, or, like, anyone might have Googled anybody else here and, like, read all this other stuff. And I think that what that does is it's really going to force us to be a lot more honest and to answer for a lot more of what we do. And I think that most people react to that by being like, well, I'm just never going to say anything online. And, you know, like, I'm just going to make sure that all my networks are locked down and whatever. But that's really getting to be more and more impossible, because you can't ever, like, you know, you don't get to police your own Google results, and you don't get to police what other people post about you. And that's always been the same. Like, you can't control what other people are going to say. But, you know, I've had discussions with people where they're like, oh, you know, what if somebody reads this, like, crazy communist rant that you posted on your blog and, like, doesn't hire you? Like, well, then, fuck you. I don't want to work for you. It's, you know, it's just like, I think that what's great about it is that, you know, you really, like, who you are and who people think that you are is going to be, maybe more open to interpretation, but sort of in a good way. You know, it's like, you know, you're fully exposed and you don't really have very much control, but you would assume that everything you've posted has something to do with you. So any entry point somebody's going to take is going to be partially valid, and you're going to have to answer for it. You know, you can't pretend that you never posted that, because you did. And I think that's really going to open up a lot of potential for very interesting social situations in which people have to consider these things that maybe we never considered before. You have a lot less deniability. So, hi.
I wanted to say, first of all, that I really liked your analogy between the casino and Facebook. I thought that was great, but that's somewhat orthogonal to what I wanted to ask, which is following up on what you've been saying about people having to be more honest about things that they've said and perhaps being held accountable for what they've said. I wonder if what we're going to see is a kind of division between people who have the means to eradicate what they've said online versus people who don't have a means of doing that. And I think right now we're in this weird sort of sweet spot where politicians are still naive enough that they tweet shit all the time that they shouldn't, and that very quickly you're going to have one of your jobs as like a spin doctor or as somebody who's an image consultant will be, how do we make sure your Wikipedia page has been edited correctly? How do we trim your tweets? How do we learn? You know, do you see that emerging and changing this kind of picture of the, you know, everyone being open?
You guys just want to go for it?
I have a lead on to that, but I also want to ask you, and it's very connected to what Annalee was asking. one thing that I've been seeing among perhaps we can think of it as technological haves and have-nots, or you know, maybe there's a different division, but individuals trying to take control over all of those different identities by just going ahead and having a single website for themselves that links all of those things, and that is more likely to come up in the Google results than just an individual, you know, post that seems unrelated to the mainstream of who you are. So the question behind that is connected to analytics, which is, you know, some people are doing that, but lots of people aren't, and some people are afraid to, and how does that play out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we really know yet, to be honest. I think that, I mean, there's already a lot of, I mean, there's already a market for image management online and for trying to go after people with takedown notices and say, you know, like, all right, I wanna get rid of this. I wanna, you know, completely remove the record. But I think that, you know, kind of this stuff that we're talking about, it's different because I'm not sure that you're ever really going to be able to do that. You know, I think that there's caching. You know, there's stuff on backup servers somewhere. You know, if you really, really, really want to dig up that poem that I posted on DeviantArt in, you know, ninth grade that was up for a week, like, I bet you can, you know, and I think that means that, like, for those of us who are aware of it, I think it means that we need to be a little bit more confident, and I've certainly been busted, you know, I've had people call me up and say, like, that was fucked up that you posted that, take it down, you know, and I think, you know, the question about the kind of social divide is really interesting, because it is sort of a question of resources and a question of knowledge and access, between, you know, who's aware that this is posted, who is, you know, who's got the in with the guy at Wikipedia who can, like, actually do something for you. And I think that's definitely a really big problem, that's part of the structure that we have now. You know, I don't think that most of the internet is as open as we think it is. I mean, you know, as my name is May Saslaw. When you Google me, I'm the only person that you get. You know,
I have that problem too.
Yeah. So it's definitely something that I think you know, people are more and more aware of, and I think the lack of control scares people. You know, I think when you know that you can't get somebody to take down a comment on Wikipedia or a news article, like, that's very frightening because it feels like a loss of control. But I wonder how much of that is really new.
There's an awful, awful, awful picture of myself on Wikimedia, and I tried to get it off, and nobody can help me. It's just there. I look awful.
Do you have a good picture of yourself?
There are tons of good pictures of myself, but there's one picture that's the official standard image of myself on Wikipedia. Not because there's this...
It gives you $20, right?
I pay you a tuna fish sandwich if you remove my image from the Wikimedia Foundation page, whatever it is. But, okay, my statement before I hand over to Adam, who wants to add a thing, is there will be a time in the future, maybe like in 5 or 10 years, when everyone will be suspicious if there is no picture of your dick on the internet. I think that will happen, really, yeah?
Yeah, well, I mean, I really think, like, I've had this conversation with people my age and people who...
I don't believe in privacy. I think privacy is bullshit. I think it does not exist and it never existed.
I think so, too.
It's a bourgeois fantasy.
And I think, like, you know, people... When you see people my age running for public office, and you see our pictures of us, like, you know, smoking pot on Facebook, like, it's not going to make us unelectable at all, because everybody's going to have them, you know, and I think that's really kind of productive, because it means that everybody is allowed to have them. At least I hope that's what's going to happen. Otherwise,
we can disavow them.
Yeah, that was exactly what my question was going to be. Like in 10 or 20 years, you know, is it going to be this issue where some people may have been managing, you know, everything they do from the beginning, like to the point where the number of actually electable people dwindles to this pool of four really boring Mormons. And,
yeah, that's, you know, the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I had friends who like were thinking about getting into, you know, the FBI or the Foreign Service or something, and this sort of gotcha issue of these like security investigations and openness of it, like, but are those things really security risks anymore? It's strange.
I don't think they ever were. You know, I mean, I think that like we just kind of have to realize that we're not, you know, nobody is as polite as they appear when you meet them, and you know, everybody likes to fuck around and drink out of red plastic cups and, you know, like write really, really dumb blog entries, and you know, like the sooner we can kind of accept that, you know, the sooner we can fucking work together.
Who wrote a really bad blog entry in his life?
Yeah, the rest of you are lying.
I think what I'm curious about is, this seems like almost a generational divide, but the generation is only a few years, you know, it's only a few years long, because I'm 38, I've been online for, you know, a few years, and it's only in the past 12 months or so that I think there's a real picture of what I really look like, you know, on my Facebook page or anything else, because for years I was using avatars. And so if you did a Google image search, you might find a picture of a guy with a gigantic neck girder playing the banjo, because that was the avatar that I used for years, you know. And I'm wondering if that kind of thing will really screw with people down the road, you know, as if they try and search you out and say, oh my God, you know, it's that.
Doesn't have a
goiter. Are you saying you're afraid people will think you have a goiter and a banjo? Or a
goiter banjo.
Identities
are static. In my case, for example, because there's if you have Facebook, they really need your data. That's the stuff that they sell. They need your interconnections, and that's what they harvest. In my case, I have 12 or 13 Facebook accounts and 12 or 13 Facebook characters, and I'm not telling you who they are. But one of them is like a 16-year-old white Aryan supremacist girl from Montana, and I played my role well. I actually drove through Montana. I took pictures of a farm there and of animals and stuff, and I used that. I said, that's how my backyard looks like, and that's where I practice shooting on Jews and all that stuff. Yeah? And the interesting thing is how many friends she has, what they travel, etc., etc., etc. You should all do that right now. Go on Facebook and do not boycott Facebook. Create multiple images of strange people on Facebook and just like over-exploit it in a certain way.
I created a Facebook profile for Adlai Stevenson, and normally they remove like celebrity profiles, but he's not notable enough that anyone really knows who he is. So it's like this picture of Adlai Stevenson, and you know, interests include being well liked whether or not he wins, and yeah, it's pretty.
I think that means Mark Zuckerberg wasn't paying attention in U.S. history class. I'm 39. I've been on the internet since I was 19 or 20. And so one thing that was true for an enormous amount of time was that I was almost unfindable because my name is two common nouns. So my name is Rose White, and if you like, once we're on the web and you could search and stuff, you just find seed catalogs or like linen catalogs and things. And it's only for me then in the last couple of years that I am findable, because people will know to search, you know, more
effectively by adding, you know, things that they think I might be associated with. One aspect of that I've heard bandied about is the idea that people will name their children things that are hard to search, you know, like really common names or
even give them really weird names so that they're easy
to search. So their Google rank, you know, is completely unique.
SEO babies?
Anyone?
More using search names seems to be much more common than my friends right now. So two things. We were trying to the discussion. The screen is intermediary is interesting because I've heard from my motorcycling friends and from my cycling friends, which is one of my alliances, lie that, you know, if you're on one of these forms of transportation, you're much more connected because you don't have this thing intermediating your experience. But of course, you point out that the velocitation of the experience of speed changes that, right? So you're sort of deluding yourself. Like, oh, okay, so I need to go spend some time thinking about that. That's pretty good. But the end discussion about the casino and I think wanting to win social interaction over, it made me think about something that, you know, sort of popped up briefly on the radar for a while and some sort of falling off by chat roulette. Which really took off explosively and really seemed to have people seem to really connect to it in a really interesting way because it combines all of the aspects of these things, you know, and you get to, if you thought about that in the context of all of these things you've been talking about.
Because I think, like, everybody was talking about chat roulette, like, right when this conference was announced, and I started, like, kicking around ideas for what I wanted to talk about, and was like, oh, I guess, like, I'm going to have to spend an afternoon on chat roulette watching guys jerk off, which I never did, because somebody was thoughtful enough to note, no, don't worry, by October, no one's going to remember chat roulette, which is kind of true. Chat roulette was funny because I think, like, I mean, I remember when we did that with AIM, and you would put yourself on, like, the public AIM directory, and, you know, people would just IM you, and, you know, they'd be like, ASL, do you like 9-inch cocks? And, like, you know, it was either, like, accept or reject. I feel like that doesn't ever really do that much for anyone other than, like, it's just kind of this weird pop phenomenon for people to point at and say, like, oh, look what they're doing on the internet. Isn't that crazy? Everybody's just jerking off. And it's, you know, it's, of course they are. But I think it's more interesting to look at stuff like that for the kind of weird, like, social experiments and art projects that people pull off with it. I remember seeing one for chat roulette where the guy just had, like, a piece of paper sideways, and it said, like, if you turn your head, I win. And it was, like, the whole video was just people going like this and then laughing. And, I mean, I think that's cool because it's using this very, very strangely mediated social interaction as a place to just kind of see what you can get away with and, like, see what another, like, what a stranger will tolerate from you, because they don't, you know, like, they don't have to stay and they don't have to see you, so it's just kind of like, you know, what am I going to do to try to capture this person's attention? I have no idea, you know, anything about them other than what comes on for just one brief second. And dicks don't really know. But I think, I mean, unless it's almost cool as an idea than it ever is as a thing when that kind of thing happens. Not just because, you know, like, it's nobody really wants to go sit and watch a bunch of people jerk off into their webcams, unless you do, which is fine. But it's not really a way to, like, meet people and have meaningful interactions if everybody's just going to treat it as, like, this kind of wild, crazy, you know, momentary thing, which is what it's designed for.
Those of us who are very active on the internet probably have had this thing happen when someone kind of comes up to you and then they start talking to you and they're talking about a conversation that you're not, that like from the middle of a conversation, like, that thing that you wrote the other day, and I really thought X about this, and you're like, what thing that I wrote the other day? What were you talking about? And as you're talking about this, it seems you're just talking about how, in kind of contrast to what you just said, I think, doesn't that sort of bring the internet to, and the means of the internet to the real world in a way? Because isn't that a sort of a way to force that kind of contextual understanding again, like really in person? And it, like the windshield analogy that you used earlier, where the car is we're almost separated from the existence of the physical world, this forces us to be merged with it in a way that's, I think dramatically different and powerful for as an educational tool, no?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I remember a couple of years there, and I guess this still goes on with certain people. It really depends on, you know, who you're friends with and how comfortable everybody is with their online activity. But when it was like, oh, did you just mention LiveJournal in real life? Like, it was this really kind of faux pas thing that, like, our online lives were supposed to be separate. And I think, at least for me, that kind of had to do with the fact that I was like 13 and everything that I was posting online was really like, you know, really deep and, you know, really, really cool and dark. And all my friends knew better than that. Like, all my friends thought that was total bullshit. So it was embarrassing to get called out on something that you had posted online, in a certain way. And I think some people, you know, still kind of have that condition where you don't want to talk about the internet in real life because what you're doing on the internet is like this sort of like trumped up, almost falsified version of who you are, and it's uncomfortable when that gets brought to light by people who actually, you know what your deal is. On the other hand, it's uncomfortable for a different reason, which is that you know, people don't want to admit that their online interactions are having a greater, you know, are kind of becoming just as important as their real life interactions. You know, they don't want to start the, you know, brunch conversation or the bar conversation about something that happened online because they feel like then, you know, then they're not really, like, they don't really have this friendship that they thought they had. Like, you know, that could have been, you know, the girl I went to middle school with who I haven't talked to in 5 years saw that same thing, so it doesn't really say a whole lot for our friendship that that's what you're going to start with. So, I mean, I think it makes people uncomfortable for a lot of reasons, but I think that, you know, it's really just important that we think about that kind of thing, you know, like, the next time, I guess I'll end with this, like, you know, the next time something happens on the internet or in real life about the internet and it kind of freaks you out, like, I can't believe this person saw that thing, or, you know, I can't believe this person said that, like, really think about why that's freaking you out. And think about, you know, what is that saying about your relations, both online and in person? Because I really think it's only through kind of considering these relations that we're ever going to understand, like, what the fuck it all means. And it's all very interesting, you know, and it's interesting to just say, like, well, that's weird, but, you know, it's time to start asking why it's so weird and what we can do with it.
Big applause for Mae Sessler.